Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We are out here in Germany at the BMW International.
Way out here.
This is the furthest east you've ever been, huh?
You
went the wrong way to go.
Korea and Australia, depending on your measurement tool, I guess.
In Europe, first east you've ever
been. Yes, correct.
Toronto, you've been to Germany before?
I have, yeah. But only to Berlin, not to Cologne or Munich.
All right, so we have an interview coming up here shortly with Ernie Els. We're going to talk about that, but kind of want to quickly run through the week and tee this up a little bit. Deej, why don't you walk us through our plan here and our schedule this week?
Yeah, so shout out to my travel agency, Tron Travel, who basically set up everything. Tron had us flying into Munich, which was not the quickest way to get to the tournament, I don't think, but it resulted in two pretty awesome days in southern Germany.
True or false, you wanted the longest possible route on the Autobahn to get to Cologne?
False, but it ended up in hindsight, it was brilliant.
Yeah, we had a couple of great days down there. Taped a bunch of video stuff. I think that'll probably illustrate kind of what we got into a little better than me talking about it. But yeah, it was great. I've never seen that part of the world before and bounced around. I think one of the big things coming over here, I had no idea what golf in Germany was like. And I mean, not that I really have, you know, a total understanding of it after 4 days or whatever, but it was pretty cool to see here. You know, Germans have to, they have licenses for everything. So you have to take a test in order to play golf. You have to be a licensed golfer. Just the whole thing. It was pretty wild scene.
I mean, well, beyond the golf, you'd never been to Germany, so what was your did it live up to your expectations?
Oh yeah,
different.
It exceeded my expectations. It's been delightful. People have been great. The scenery's been awesome. Architecture's been awesome. The food's been phenomenal. We had some beers.
We did have some beers.
Yeah, it's pretzels. I mean, I feel like we did the very touristy things and the very, you know, hopefully a couple off the beaten path things.
We did not go to Hofbräuhaus.
I was gonna say, even on the touristy stuff that we did, we try to find the more local flavor of that touristy stuff.
Yeah, it was great.
It's good.
Yeah,
we did pretty good. So much of the story of the European tour is about the destinations, the places you go. And it's so cool. I mean, the European tour is such a worldwide tour. To go to an actual continental European city and be in that is cool. It's just cool to come here and see that, you know, in a major city in Germany, the biggest country in Europe, to see a tournament going on and the operations and all the people that go to it and everything. It was a treat. It was.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So this interview with Ernie Els, first of all, a big thank you to our partners at BMW. They have been teed us up for success. They helped set up this interview. They had us out to this tournament and we had absolute blast. I know that sometimes the partnership talk is not the most well received here, but these are the people that helped tee us up to succeed. And I think that they've given us every opportunity to. It's our fault if it doesn't go through, shine through very well.
It's funny. We were talking earlier. I think DJ said, he was like, man, like we're so used to getting told no.
Getting told no or getting told like, yeah, we might be able to make that happen. And it just never, you know, just, I guess this is probably more of a commentary on America, but yeah, everything that we've been, you know, told or ideas that have been floated, it has come through.
Just doesn't work out.
Oh God, no, it's just, but this week it's just been,
it's like nobody blows smoke up your ass. They just, if they can't do something, they tell you that. Or
yeah,
if they,
exactly. Like you were saying, Solly, I think the partnership stuff, I'm sure people can roll their eyes sometimes when we start saying that stuff, but it's so true that, I mean, we try to our hardest to only pick partners that, you know, make us better and make, you know, give us opportunities to do really cool things. And I think this week was a perfect example of that. I don't think we talked to Ernie Els without having a reason to be over here in Germany at this event. And I mean, the whole thing was just a really, really cool week. So yeah, huge thanks to them.
I mean, Ernie missed the cut. This was after his Friday round, missed the cut, and the tournament director asked him to do this interview.
And he shot 80.
Yeah.
And he conditions were brutal.
Yeah.
Great. Put a smile on his face and met with three bearded dudes he'd never met before and sat and talked golf with us. We had 30 minutes. We spent 40. It's one of our favorite interviews I think we've ever done, all considering the circumstances and his stature in the game. So without further ado, we're going to turn it over to that. Thank you for to the BMW folks here for having us out, the fine folks of Munich and the Alps and everywhere we've been. It's been a special treat of a trip. And
and when you get to the one more jet story, he just kind of smirked and kind of
we do ask him about the stories of his plane. He kind of gives some verbal clues like, all right, let's move on from this. But he does answer it very, very well. So be excited for that. So one final thing before we turn it over to the interview, I want to tell you guys about this incredible magazine that we picked up from our friends at Callaway Golf. They collaborated with Whalebone Magazine, which is an award-winning quarterly publication and an authentic lifestyle brand based out of New York, to produce what they've called the Golf Issue. So let me start by saying it's not your typical golf magazine. It's filled with some of the most artistic and creative and approachable spreads I've seen in a golf publication. We especially love the behind-the-scenes look at renowned sports photographer Walter Yost's favorite golf photos and the stories behind it. Even Michelle Wee contributed in the Rad Girls of Golf spread, which is a look at a few junior girls already taking the game by storm. So there's a surprise every time you turn the page, and I'm not quite positive what kind of paper they use, but the texture of this thing is amazing. It's a special edition book and has a massive coffee table appeal. To get your copy, go to shopwhalebone.com and click on the golf category. They won't last long, so please do hustle. And there's also some very limited edition gear available too, like custom OGO stand bags and some sandblasted Mac Daddy 4 wedges stamped by the master, Anthony Toronto. So go to shop.whalebone.com to pick up the Golf Issue and some merch, because you're sure as hell not getting mine. So turning over to Ernie here now, we do bypass any formal introduction of any kind, get right into the interview. So please do enjoy, and thank you for tuning in. All right, Ernie, you are known as one of the most international players in the world. Where does your inspiration for traveling to play golf all over the world come from?
No, I think it's just from my heritage. I mean, South African born, and, you know, in the tip of Africa, you know, you if you wanted to play or get it anywhere in the world map as a golfer, you had to travel, you know. So I've been traveling since I was a young boy. I think I was 13, 14 when I made my very first long trip to San Diego, California. That's about as long as it gets too. You know, it's about a 27-hour trip to there. So, yeah, it's just it's in our blood, I guess, from down in South Africa. You have to travel to get anywhere.
Well, a lot of people aspire to make a career out of the PGA Tour. Once you've done that and made a very successful career out of the PGA Tour, you still traveled a lot internationally. Is that kind of just that was kind of instilled in you from that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, when I got into the European Tour first, you know, so it's kind of my next stop out of South Africa was the European Tour. And then kind of got myself onto the US Tour in 93, 94. And I just found myself playing both tours. It's not like I wanted to. It just, you know, kind of just worked out that way. My first base out of South Africa was really in London. So I really got familiar with London, and it's a great city. And then kind of got myself a little spot in Orlando, Florida, back in the early 90s. So I had kind of two bases out of South Africa, the main one in London and then Orlando later. So it just kind of morphed into what it is today, really, just by accident.
If you could marry the best elements of the two main tours, of the PGA Tour and the European Tour, how would that look? What would that look like?
Well, I love the food in Europe. I mean, I love the food in the U.S., obviously, but, you know, you got so many different cultures over here in Europe, so many different countries, and just love eating, yeah. I just love eating and go, you know, full stop. But love the food over here. I think the golf courses in the U.S., you know, condition-wise, week in and week out, it's a little bit better than over here. Here you have very different conditions from week to week. This week in Germany, next week in France, and then you go to Lynx Golf. After that, you know, the Irish and the Scottish, and then the British. So very different conditions. You've got to adapt all the time, which is also interesting and nice. You know, it's not just a kind of a cookie cutter every week's the same. You know, it's a little different over here, which I like. But it's a lot easier in the States. You know, if you base yourself there and, you know, move from tournament to tournament in the States, it's a lot easier on the body and on the family, really.
What when did you hit the point where you decided, okay, I need to get my own plane?
Well, I just fell into that one too. You know, you know, when the kids were young, I felt I wanted to try and keep them with me on the road. You know, I had a couple of good years and I had a couple of good deals, to be honest with you. That's the only reason I got into that expensive little hobby. But it's been really fun. You know, I've just sold the airplane. Mm-hmm. I'm back on to with NetJets again. But for a very long time, I could have my family with me. I mean, as we talked about, I mean, I played everywhere from South Africa to Australia to Dubai to Fiji, Hawaii.
You won in Japan.
Singapore, yeah. Japan. I mean, you name it. And the kids were with us. I mean, we were like a little, we were like a bunch of gypsies for about 10 years, you know. Just everywhere we went, the kids came, and I could not have done it without the airplane. So I had a real great bonding experience with my kids when they were really young, which is important.
What was the biggest culture shock of all of those places? What was the moment that kind of shook you the most?
I mean, there are many places we've gone, you know, but I don't think they can quite prepare you for India. You know, India was, we heard about, you know, a lot of people there and, you know, all that. We loved it, but still, you know, going into Delhi, I think there's like 22 million people in downtown Delhi, and I loved it, but it was a lot of people. I mean, especially where I come from in South Africa, there's only about 20,000 people in this little town where I live, and to go into 22 million people was quite a shock.
That's how it feels like going to Orlando for me.
Where are you from?
No, I'm from a small town in Illinois. I lived in Orlando for a while, though, and it was yeah, probably not quite that bad, but yeah, a lot of traffic.
It's growing.
We're just up the road from you now. We're in Jacksonville, so we find our way down through Orlando a decent amount. But we've heard stories a lot about the plane, about the traveling on the plane.
A hot topic right now in the States.
I hear that. I mean, we've had some interesting flights, obviously.
They don't talk about the flights with your family too
often.
Yeah,
I know. You know, I'm trying to keep it clean here.
No, you don't have to. You can do whatever you like.
No, we've had some interesting flights, obviously. You know, invite my friends onto the plane, you know, give them a ride where I can. You know, there's on the aeroplane, very seldom on long flights that we drink water. You know, definitely enough beer on the plane. A lot of the guys, my caddy Ricky used to fly with me a lot, and he said that, you know, he thought that the plane could run on Heineken beer. You know, we had so much in there. So
only
from
Heineken?
Steve Marino.
That's the big one that keeps floating
Adam
around.
Scott, Scotty is like a little brother to me. He flew with me a lot. Dustin Johnson, I mean, all the guys, everybody flew with me. But the Marino one is obviously the one everyone wants to talk about. And it was just myself and Stevie from Japan all the way down to Palm Beach. And, I mean, we had a lot to drink. It was the end of the year, and it was a long way down to Florida. So, yeah, you know, there was a lot to talk about, and you know, we kind of hugged each other. You know, it was a love fest in the airplane, but nobody got really seriously injured or anything like that, and it was all in good fun.
As I say, I heard at the end of that. Hands were shook at the end. I was like, all right, we'll see you later, pal. That's it.
Exactly, like nothing happened. It was just, I don't know, it's just what guys do, I guess, you know. There's a lot of testosterone running.
We've heard that guys are required to surf the airplane.
Yeah, we surfed a couple of landings.
Okay. Who's the best surfer, Adam Scott?
Yeah, Scotty was not bad. You know, he's a little bit light, but you know, you gotta have good footing coming in.
It's more like a longboard.
But really, you gotta have a good pilot, and hopefully he doesn't have to put the emergency brakes on, because he'd be through the front the front window. But everybody surfed the landing, everybody I can remember.
Well, so you mentioned, you know, before we got on, just kind of feeling a little jet lagged and stuff. Did that, have you always been a good traveler? Is that stuff starting to catch up with you now later in your career?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I guess as you get older that you find it difficult to sleep sometimes, you know, and I just find it very difficult always throughout my career to go west to east. I guess you guys are the same.
You lose
maybe.
Time.
I mean,
yeah.
You just kind of. I can't get to sleep till 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and it's not good when you have a 8 o'clock tea time.
Yeah.
You know, and I just felt out of sorts today. I don't know. I've done pretty well with jet lag throughout my career, but I think it gets tougher as you get older.
Yeah. Yeah. The more you think, the more you do it, the more you adjust to it. But
it's not true.
It's not the case.
Yeah. I mean, every hour is a day. You know, if it's a 5-hour time change, it takes 5 days, and that's historically. That's just been my way, so you can't shortcut it.
I almost found going to Asia even better. You screw up so badly that it almost resets, but I think Europe and the U.S. is actually really tough.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's just enough to really screw you up. When you go to Asia, you miss a whole day. You kind of, you know, recalibrate.
And it's tough here, too, because it really doesn't get dark till
11 o'clock.
10:30, 11, you know, it's still dusky out.
I know. Well, you know. I've made enough excuses. I just gotta just. I think I need some rest. I need like good 3 weeks away and kind of see where we go from there.
We're tired and we haven't had to play golf this week. So I'm not fully ready to move on from the plane though. I want to know who are the best traveling companions on the flight, like the best hangs.
All of them. I mean, all the guys. I mean, we've had all the way from, as I say, Stevie. I mean, I've had the whole tour. I mean, Camila Villegas, Dustin, Jamie Lovemark, Keegan Bradley, Justin Rose.
Can anyone not hang?
Everybody. No, everybody hung. Everybody. It's Henrik Stenson, he doesn't have too many. You know, he was with me from Korea. Gray McDowell, we had a great time. Thomas Bjorn is another one that doesn't really have anything, but you know, we forced them to have a good time. Rolling Stones with Blair all the time. Start Me Up as we get in the aeroplane.
Oh man.
We were like rock stars, you know. We really enjoyed it. I mean, I really got a lot out of the aeroplane, and my pilot stayed with me for 17 years, you know, Rob. So he's maybe the one to talk to. Also.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you too much.
Well, no, it's great. You gave us enough. If you weren't going to give us the stories, we were going to go to the sources and get the stories about it. And so you gave us enough that we won't go digging too much.
Yeah. But
no, that's great. So we have a question that we like to ask both young players and older players about their careers and their earnings and everything. And one thing, theory that we have is how much money that Tiger has put in the pockets of other players, essentially. So we always like to ask, if, in your opinion, how much money would you say Tiger has earned you over the course of your career?
Many. I got to thank him. I got to really thank him. I mean, he was a little better than me, so he took a little bit of money out of my pocket on the course, you know, playing. But the purses just went up ridiculously. I mean, I remember when I came out, I think in 1994, that was kind of pre-Tiger. Tiger came out in 96. You know, I won $360,000 was my first prize for the U.S. Open in 94.
Wow.
And just a couple of years later, you know, it was $1 million.
In 97.
Yeah.
This past week it was $2 million.
And this past week it was $2 million. So what he's done for the ratings... I mean, all you guys, I mean, really brought in mainstream media, spectators, I mean, you name it. I mean, even across the pond,
oh yeah,
so to speak, you know, over here, prize money has gone up, popularity's gone up. It's just been an amazing run.
How do you, you know, with all the international travel you've done and international wins and stuff, do you feel like you're more... appreciated inside the U.S. or outside the U.S. from a golf perspective?
Yeah, interesting. I luckily, you know, I've gelled well with both sides. You know, the crowds in the U.S. You know, I've had a good rapport with them, and the same over here in Europe and even Asia. You know, I guess when you're long around, as long as I've been around, you know, people kind of recognize you. I don't think I've been the biggest ass out there. I've been this morning. I was maybe a little bit of an ass, but you know, it was a tough morning.
Jet lag. It's jet lag.
Yeah, yeah. But for the most part, you know, I try and have a good time with them. Then they've given me some love back. So it's been a wonderful ride for a very long time. So
I think it's your tempo. Who could not root for you? Watching.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what it is, but it's been good. You know, you know, when you get older, you know, you still want to try and play the way you used to, but you know, it's kind of starting to go a little bit. But they've respected me, you know, even though I've gone south a little bit.
It's got to be hard, I imagine, to find that balance between, you know, treating, like, for fans and stuff. People are going to be coming up to you for eternity, and you almost have to decide where to draw the line. Even walking from the scoring tent to here, I mean, people stopping you, and you have, it's got to be hard and frustrating to figure out who to say yes to and who to say no to when it's really kind of just a luck of the draw.
You really just want to get out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can't do that either. You know, the people, it's funny when you meet the same people as you're going up as when you're coming the other way. And, you know, I've felt that if you can treat them good going this way, you know, they might be nice to you when you're going the other way, because it's really a vicious circle. It can be. So I think that it's part and parcel of being out here for a long time. Is you want to be friends with the guys playing, and you want to be okay with the spectators. You know, it could be a long road out here if you're not if you don't have a rapport with people.
We were doing just a bit of research for looking into, and I don't remember this happening. We were, I think, all in high school when it happened. But in 2004, we saw there was a letter you received once from Tim Fincham about requesting that you play the PGA Tour more frequently. What was even the kind of the basis of that? How did that come about? I mean, that just seems kind of insane looking back at it now.
Yeah, I mean, even today still, I mean, I hear the youngsters talking, you know, and a lot of the youngsters are struggling to play 15 events. In my day back then, Tim wanted us to play more than 15, closer to 20 events. And I felt that was getting really tight for me. You know, in my heyday, I never really played many more than 17 events on the US Tour. I mean, I wish I played a bit more, but, you know, I had a lot of events to play. But, yeah, Tim really was pushing on that, and then eventually we pushed back, you know, against it, and now you guys only have to play 15. So I remember Seve Ballesteros, a lot of the guys before me had the same issue with him, and then eventually we kind of got to a good grounding where he was happy with the events I was playing, and I think now the guys, you know, playing 15 is a lot better than playing 18. I mean, he would have nobody playing on that tour, and I think Tiger had something to do with that too, maybe.
Yeah. Kind of what he says usually goes.
Yeah, exactly.
So we want to kind of go through some of your best memories of your career and just kind of ask what the first thing you think of is when you think of the 1994 U.S. Open. What's the first memory you have or the best story you have from that Open?
Just hot. Just weather. I think still today, I don't think we've played in warmer weather.
Really?
You know, even Singapore and Malaysia, I mean, it was 105. And the index must have felt like 115. I mean, it was a freaking oven.
That was Congressional, right?
That was actually Pittsburgh.
Oakmont. Oh, right. 94 is Oakmont.
Oakmont, yeah.
I mean, the first thing you think of is heat. You don't think of your winning your first major.
I think of that. And, you know, I haven't really looked at that tape for quite some time. But I remember my wife, my girlfriend then, Liesl, and myself, how young we were. I mean, we were 24, but we were a young 24. If I look around these kids now, you know, they kind of a bit more worldly. Maybe not worldly, it's not the right word, but they're a bit more mature than we were. I remember, you know, the Monday, we finished on the Monday. I remember sitting in the clubhouse upstairs with some friends, you know, obviously drinking some beer again, talking bad beer, and watching the O.J. Simpson deal go down.
Oh, wow.
You know, that was the Bronco.
That's right.
Yeah,
that was Arnold's last round.
And Arnold, absolutely. I was watching Arnold, you know.
There was something else, like NBA Finals or something. Yeah. Was that same day?
And NHL,
Finals,
I think.
Finals, NHL. Yeah. I think the not Pittsburgh, the Rangers, New York Rangers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They won.
What a day.
After that, I actually got to meet Mark Messier.
Oh yeah,
I remember he won the Stanley Cup. So yeah, a lot of stuff happened in '94, man.
Seriously, that week alone. Yeah. Jeez. All right. What about 1997 at Congressional? Well, first about '94, I was stunned to see that in the playoff that you started bogey triple.
Yeah.
And you won the 18. Or you tied Lauren Roberts into that playoff.
That happens a miracle because that's probably the toughest golf course in the world, and being four over after two holes, and then playing the next 16 holes and one under par, and then going into the sudden death with Lauren. I don't think Lauren got over this one because he must have thought I was gone.
Yeah.
How did this guy catch me? And I kind of just snuck myself back in. They got into a playoff, and then it went my way. Yeah. So, you got to feel for Lauren. But, that was a crazy, crazy week, crazy day. I mean, long week, 90 holes.
I always remember Lauren. I didn't remember Colin Montgomery in that first playoff, too. So you beat him in
Monty was there, too. Yeah, I mean, Monty... and I guess Monty must have run out of gear, because on the Monday it was still like 107 degrees, and he, as a Scotsman, had all black on.
Oh.
So, I think he was a little warm going off the first tee, and it might have showed in his play. I don't know. I think we were all just a bit tired, but it was interesting to see him in all black.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Pretty...
You can guess where we're going to go next. 97 U.S. Open.
97. I mean, I remember my parents being there. And obviously you remember the 17th hole and, a clutch putt on 18. And then seeing 17 unfold behind me. You could see everything unfold there. With Maggot going in the water, Tom Lehman going in the water, Monty... just missing his putt on 17. I played with him. So kind of nerve-wracking stuff, but I felt that was the most comfortable I ever felt in a major.
Did it feel different the second time, like winning the second for the second time?
Yeah, I was obviously I was a bit more established as a player. Won quite a few events since 94 on the tour there. I was close to being number one in the world, so I was kind of becoming... quite an established player, and felt very comfortable that whole week for some reason. Although, at the end there, I had to make some clutch putts and clutch shots, the 5-iron on 17, hitting it in there. I was the only one to par it of the final guys, and then parring 18 with a 5-footer. Those are the things I really remember. And then remembering my father being there on Father's Day, that was a really... really special time.
Outside of the majors, what victory are you most proud of?
I've had quite a few, thankfully, but the ones that stand out, I won 7 world match plays. That was something that nobody's done before at Wentworth. I won three straight Heineken Classics on one of the best golf courses in the world, Royal Melbourne.
That mean a lot. Mean extra to you. Say
exactly. I just wanted to mention that. Exactly. That's where the beard came from. But to shoot 60 around Royal Melbourne, that course record will hopefully hold up for a while. That was really special.
We played there in November, and we did not.
Yeah, the record.
Are you were there?
We were there.
We were there with Zach Pryor, he was 6 under through 5, I think. We were like, all right, maybe he's got a shot at this, and then kind of went by the wayside after that.
No, it's an unbelievable place. I mean, great course, and now the President's Cup's going back there, and the '98 President's Cup, the only one we ever won, was at Royal Melbourne. So there's a kind of a nice ring to that in Australia. And then in South Africans and Australians, historically, we don't get along. In sporting terms, we don't get along. So it was kind of strange that I had such a nice affinity with Royal Melbourne.
What's the rivalry mostly there? Cricket or rugby?
It's cricket and rugby, mostly anything. I'm not a surfer, but I know surfing, they got better surfers than us at the moment. But
have they had your number in cricket or rugby, or what's the recent?
For a little bit there, they had us in cricket for about 3 or 4 years there. But you know, now they're kind of struggling with a lot of things at the moment, but hopefully they can pull us through in this President's Cup.
How did the process for you becoming the President's Cup captain work? And did you have 2019 as the year that you knew you wanted to, or who approaches who? How does that process work?
No, I'm not sure. I mean, Nick Price asked me to help him at Liberty a couple of years ago. And then, you know, we weren't sure who was going to be captain. And then the next thing I heard that, you know, Jay Monahan said that I should be captain, and I really jumped at it. You know, there's no real set way of how new captains come in. Yeah. I'm not sure who's going to be the next guy.
It's a fantastic host course to be able to captain at.
Absolutely.
Will you have any latitude as far as how to set up the course? I know that's kind of been a point of contention in the past with the international
team. I tried,
team.
But they've got their rules set. Neither of the captains really has a big advantage, you know, whether the U.S. captain in the U.S. doesn't get that much advantage, and the same with us down there. The only thing going for me is that I know the course very well, and I've got a very comfortable way of going to Australia. You know, I know Melbourne very well, I know the hotel very well, and I know the conditions very well. So I can give that to the players. I already told them that. Whatever they need to know about that course, you know, I can give them a little bit of...
There's a pretty good feeling that it'll be firm and fast.
Yeah. Too. I mean, at that time of the year, it'll be early December. Conditions can be like this, mm-hmm. believe it or not, and then the next day it can be 100 degrees. Yeah. You know, it's got a different climate down there in Melbourne. I mean, I'm sure you guys have been there.
We were out on that golf course, and it was about 95 degrees, and a breeze came from the opposite direction, and the temperature dropped 20 degrees in 8 seconds. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's almost like San Francisco, Cape Town. Yeah. I mean, you can go places around the world. It's amazing.
When you're looking to pick players for that team, what do you think you base that on? Is it kind of, you know, past victories and experience and that stuff? Is it recent form? Is it who fits the course?
Probably yeah, it's interesting. Stuff. I mean, all of those above that you mentioned, I think I got four picks. You know, eight guys are going to qualify through the world rankings, and then I got four picks. And I've already told the guys that I will look at guys who have done well at the Royal Melbourne. You know, if there's a local guy and he's in real good form, I might throw him in a hat and ask the guys if they're okay with that. I really want to have the guy's influence in the four picks this time around, because they have to play with these guys. You know, I want them to be really comfortable with them. It's not, there's no use of me picking guys and the other guys aren't comfortable. So yeah, I mean, I think a guy that's an expert around Royal Melbourne might have a good chance of getting in the team.
As someone who, at the time, you'd already won three majors, been under the pressure of major championships, that playoff in the 2003 President's Cup against Tiger, with all of your teammates, all of the pressure riding on you and everything that was at stake, did that feel different than being in contention in a major?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it was totally different. I mean, I was more nervous there than anywhere else, because in a major, if you screw up, it's yourself, you. You blame yourself and, you know, you get out of town. But if you screw up in front of your teammates, for your team, for a cup, very different, you know. I can sense now what NBA guys must feel like, you know, at
shooting
the free
throw
line.
Yeah.
Exactly, for the championship or going for a three-pointer and stuff like that. I mean, it is on the line. And in golf, it's not a moving sport like NBA or tennis. So you got a lot of time to think about your next shot. And all your guys are there and the crowds are there. It was tough. And I'm very glad that both of us made putts, because it would have been hard on either of us if we didn't make those putts and somebody had to lose. And almost thankfully it went dark, because...
What did you think of the decision, I guess, to tie? I mean,
yeah,
there wasn't another decision, I don't think.
It's unique, because I think it was a good decision, because, I mean, you're very close to Thanksgiving. I mean, at the end of the day, there's more life, you know, after golf. And the Americans, the guys, their plane was ready. They were going to go back to the States. There were things that were set in place. People had to be places the next day. So I think the right decision was made. You're so far away from the rest of the world in Africa. You know, you sleep and then the next day go out there and play. I think it could have been really unfair on either side.
You guys should write in the captain's agreement that if it comes down to a tie, you and Tiger as the captains have to break
nah.
the tie.
No, I think he's in better form than I am at the moment.
Well, you got a year. You can work on it. Yeah.
No, I think we'll give it to the guys. Let the boys okay. Struggle.
That's right. That's nice of you. Yeah. Let them have the moment.
Let me sit on the sideline for this one.
What is the current status of your game? What are your goals, I guess, for this stage of your career? What are you working on, and what are you hoping to get out of this stage of your career?
Well, I was trying to get a bit of form this year, but it hasn't quite come around. But I'm looking forward to the Open Championship is my next major, and I might play the Scottish Open. But you know, I'll be 49 in October, and 50 next October. I've got the President's Cup coming up. I'm going to give that my full attention, and I want to play, but I think I'm going to play a little bit less than I have been. You know, I can feel. Yeah, and also my frustration level is sky high because I'm not playing the way I want to play, and that really frustrates me. And
what part of your game are you most frustrated with?
It's my mental game. I mean, my physical game is not bad. I just make the most silly errors that you cannot believe. And I remember speaking to some of my mentors, you know, Nick Price, Greg Norman, Nick Faldo, and they all say that they'll be playing perfectly well, or everything's fine, and then out of the blue, something happens. It's like, where did that come from? And that's kind of what I'm going through now. I'm going fine, and then out of the blue, I do something like you would never even imagine as a rookie. So that those are the frustrating things. You know, other than that, I'm perfectly fine. So we'll see where it goes. I mean, I'd like to play. I want to play competitively, and I want to feel like I have chances to win. I don't want to be missing cuts and play off weeks.
Will you play the Champions Tour at all?
Definitely.
Yeah,
I'll play the Champions Tour. And that's why I think I need to be fresh, because those boys are playing.
It seems everyone that turns 50, everyone says, oh, he's going to tear up the tour, and it's not the case.
No, it's not happening. It's very competitive.
And it's a different style of golf a little bit, too. You're just firing at flags, and you got to
– I know. You got to be on. I mean, you got to make 7-8 birdies a day, you know, and the guys are doing that, you know. So I'm looking forward to playing golf courses we can actually – make birdies and get to par fives and two again and stuff like that. But you're going to have your game. I mean, all these guys are ready to go. And we're going to have a big class of 69. You know, there's a lot of my guys going in. I mean, Retief's going in, you know, Jimmy Furyk, you know, there's so many. I mean, Angel Cabrera, I mean, Darren Clark's going in. So there's about 10, 12 of us coming. So it'll be very competitive.
What did you think of how Shinnecock Hills ended up playing out?
Yeah, it was unfortunate. I mean, it's one of the best golf courses on the planet. I mean, I think it's ranked number 3 or 4. So you got an unbelievable venue. And to mess it up like that again is just crazy. You know, when the fairways were that wide, maybe the USJ thought that they had to really get going with the greens, which they did. You know, even the first day we played in the afternoon, and all the flags were right on the edges. It was really right on the line of being unfair already on Thursday. Then the rains came on Friday morning, softened things up, and then they let it go again on Saturday, putting flags all over on mounds and almost off the greens. So I'm a little bit disappointed. Not little, I'm quite disappointed. I mean, that was my 25th straight year playing in the US Open. So I've seen them all, you know, and it seems like we keep going back every now and again to where the USGA just can't find their happy medium of just letting the golf course be. You know, you got one of the best iconic golf courses in the whole of the world, and you go and try and really get tricky with the golf course. It's just not shouldn't happen.
What was your favorite setup that you saw, whether it's one that you won or not?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some really good ones, but I would say in my 25 years, I would say there's been half good and half bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't mind playing a tough course and getting it in tough shape for us to score on, but be fair and don't kill the greens. You know, it seems like the greens die when the USGA go there. Pebble Beach in 2010, it was a joke. It was terrible. You know, the greens with the Pohanna was dead, and the green, I mean, it was terrible. It's one of the best golf courses in the world again. I just don't get it.
Comparing your win, or the setup for your win at Oakmont in 94 versus the setup.
Yeah, you see there too, you know, the Saturday, we could hold the greens. I remember shooting 66 on a Saturday at Oakmont. And a lot of my friends said, because I shot 70, I think I shot 73 or 4 on the final day, they said, oh, you were choking, you choked. I said, sure, I choked a little bit, but I couldn't get near a flag. Where I could shoot at the flags on Saturday, on Sunday, they took the moisture out of the place, and they put the flags on positions, and you couldn't really score. So, you know, it was dictated of how the golf course was set up again. You know, the conditions can just fluctuate so much, which I really don't get. So, you know,
yeah.
Hopefully they get it right, because they just haven't had it right. I mean,
they got some
Chambers
great
Bay was pathetic. Then you had last year at a new golf course. It felt like a tour tournament, you know, 16 under wins. And then this year they do that to Shinnecock. So I don't know where this thing's going to end.
A couple more, we'll let you get out of here. We appreciate your time. But first, want to know, what are you most proud of in your entire career?
Wow, that's a good one. I should have thought about that one. You know, being out here for quite some time, you know, I turned pro back in 1990, and playing, I think, all over the world and winning all over the world. I think that's really something. And I mean, you know, and just having a good rapport with people. I think leaving the stage, I think, is important, that you leave with some dignity, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the game beats the hell out of you, but I'm still in good stead with the fans, with the players, and so forth. And really playing a worldwide schedule. I think we touched on that. I think that made me a little bit different, and I did it my whole career, which was kind of nice.
And I think most people would agree that your foundation work, Els for Autism, is one of the most recognizable names in the golf world, I guess, when it comes to charity work. Can you tell us about the passion that is behind your foundation
and
work?
And was there many foundations when you started it? It seems like every golfer kind of has a foundation now, which I know is a big drive of the tour. But was there much of that when you started it, or was it a pretty new idea?
Well, you know, you got to give the PGA Tour credit. I mean, they are a charity-based organization. I mean, that drives them. Every tournament we go to, there's charity dollars being given to local charities. So, you know, you have a pretty good understanding of what the tour is all about. I was lucky enough that I had things go my way, and my parents could send me overseas. So my first thought before my family came around was to help junior golfers have the opportunity to be able to do what I did, get out of South Africa and go and try and play overseas. I mean, that our exchange rate compared to the dollar and the pound is really weak. So you have to have a lot of capital to leave the country. So my first deal that we did was a foundation for junior golf. Guys were pretty good. We would help them through school, and give them the opportunity to go overseas and play. And then the family came around, especially with Ben. And when Ben was born with autism, you know, when we got our heads around it, myself and my wife started Elves for Autism. And, you know, we moved our base from London to the US, because in London there wasn't the care that my boy could get. It wasn't good enough. We were very comfortable in Florida, and the US people are just the most unbelievable people. We raised money and we've built this one-of-a-kind school for autism in Florida. And this kind of school is exactly what the people of autism needs right around the world. So hopefully governments, people will come and look at the school and build 100 of these things. Because my boy has gone through the roof. He would absolutely hate going to school. I had to drag him out of the house, in the car, out of the car, into the class, kicking, screaming. He cannot wait to get his ass out of the house, in the car, out of the car, at school. And now we got to drag him out of school to go home. That's how it's flipped in our lives.
That's so cool.
And that is where it's at. So it's really changed our world, changed our lives, and you know, we need to keep going.
Awesome. All right, Ernie, we took up more time of yours than we asked for. So
thanks,
we'll let you go. I appreciate you stopping in with us and telling some stories.
Thanks a lot. Great. Appreciate it. Thank you. We kept it clean.
Yeah.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most.